From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what's behind the tug of war between state lawmakers and the Department of Education over the best way to measure the progress of students and the effectiveness of their teachers?
There's a bit of a turf battle over who's making these decisions and who's paying for them.
Plus, Grand Valley State University's new music ensemble is launching a new project, Music in Our Parks.
So I was trying to think of a way that I could combine my passions, music and the outdoors, and this is what I came up with.
And Alcoholics Anonymous and the power of Bill W.'s big book.
It is still as relevant today as it was 75 years ago.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Some 30 million copies have been sold in its 75-year lifespan. The official name? Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. On today's Stateside, we take a look back at the roots of AA and the following it's gained. I'm Cynthia Canty. Also this hour, the new music ensemble at Grand Valley State University is launching an exciting new project, Music in Our Parks. We'll head outside later in the hour. But first, 3 years have passed since the state legislature agreed to come up with a way to test Michigan students. It was 2011 when state lawmakers passed and Governor Rick Snyder signed a measure designed to toughen up Michigan's teacher evaluation system. How do you measure a teacher's effectiveness? Well, one big way is determine how much a student has learned during the school year, and you do it through academic testing. But 3 years out, believe it or not, the legislature has not managed to agree on just how those evaluations should be conducted, even which tests should be used to measure student growth. And left twisting in the wind are school administrators, principals, and teachers wondering which standardized tests they're supposed to start giving this fall. Let's turn now to Brian Smith, statewide education reporter for MLive. Thanks so much for talking with us today, Brian.
Glad to be here.
So let's try to get first things first. If it was that important to put teeth into Michigan's teacher evaluation system, why has Lansing not been able to get its collective act together in 3 years since passing this reform and figure out which test should replace the 40-year-old MEEP test?
Well, I think the Michigan Department of Education would say is that they have gotten their act together and decided. The state agreed in 2011 that they were going to participate in the Smarter Balanced Assessment Consortium, which is a rather long name, but it's essentially a group of states who have worked together to design a single test that they could give in multiple states that derives the questions that it's asking ultimately from the Common Core state standards, which have been something of a political issue here in the state as well. But the test is designed to sort of assess how students are doing on those particular topics in English, language arts, and math. And the Michigan Department of Education stopped development on the MEEP in 2011 as they started to transition to the Smarter Balance test.
It just, you stop and you say, it's been 3 years. They've been working on Smarter Balance to get ready. They haven't been, polishing up and updating the MEEP. You have State Superintendent Mike Flanagan saying the MEEP is not an option for the next school year. And then you have Republican State Representative Tom McMillan of Rochester Hills, and he told you Flanagan's flat-out lying?
That's what he said to me. And another issue in all this is the state currently holds a waiver from federal No Child Left Behind law that they were granted by the U.S. Department of Education. And as a part of that, the state was committed to giving a test that measures how students are growing throughout the year, that measures their performance, not just in terms of how well they know the standards, but are they getting at least a year's worth of learning for each year that they're in school. And in the course of getting that waiver, the state agreed that they were going to implement this new test. They've chosen the Smarter Balance test. There are a couple other testing options that the state could have gone with. They ultimately chose to go with Smarter Balance. And so if the state doesn't give that test as they've promised the federal government they're going to, the federal government can come in and say that they're in violation of their waiver, and then the full list of regulations that come with the No Child Left Behind Act would immediately go into place, as just happened in Washington State recently.
So where do we stand with the legislature? What needs to happen there in order to decide, land on something, and something that doesn't wind up costing dearly in terms of losing that federal flexibility waiver?
Well, if you ask some of the folks in the legislature, they say that this is a process that they weren't consulted on, that the Department of Ed sort of made this decision without getting the legislature to sign off on how much it's going to cost. And so there's some pushback that it's, you know, the Department of Ed has sort of usurped the appropriations authority that the legislature has. Governor Rick Snyder told me during an interview last week that this is something that they need to be sensitive to, this idea that the state could lose its waiver if this testing issue is not resolved. But he's approaching it as sort of the kind of debates that happen over a budget over the course of time. This is something that they're going to be trying to work through with all the legislators to make sure that people are comfortable with the idea of what test we're giving and how much it's going to cost, and deal with the issue of, do we make a decision that could jeopardize this waiver and ultimately cost schools a lot more money because of some of the more difficult provisions that come with the No Child Left Behind Act going back into effect in Michigan, and essentially labeling every school in the state as failing because they haven't reached those milestones that were in that decade-old law.
Brian, have problems this messy happened in other states as they transition to Common Core?
Well, as I mentioned, Washington State actually just, they haven't lost their waiver directly, but the U.S. Department of Education has let them know they're not going to be renewing it. That is in large part because of teacher evaluations. The state legislature in Washington did not pass legislation that tied teacher evaluations directly to test performance, similar to here in Michigan. And because of that, their school districts will immediately be required to notify parents that they've been identified as failing, because the federal law said that by this point, you have to have 100% of your students proficient in core subjects, reading, math. And if you don't, then your school is failing, and we have to take these steps to sort of turn around your school because you're not at that level. It's certainly a complicated issue, and in a larger sense, there have been fights over these sorts of tests in other states. You've had several states that have decided to withdraw from another testing group that's been developing some exams. And the state of South Carolina agreed recently that they're going to pull out a Smarter Balanced as well.
And then meantime, in the trenches, if you will, there are the teachers and the principals and the administrators of the school districts that are wondering what they're supposed to be giving next year.
Absolutely. You have school districts that have been preparing for these tests for 3 years, because after the Common Core was adopted and it became clear that the state was going to be giving a test other than the MEAP, teachers and administrators are starting to work to develop their curriculum guides to make sure that they're teaching the material that is going to be covered on these tests, and that school districts are also preparing technologically to give these sorts of exams, because you're going to need computers, you're going to need internet access to make sure that you can test all your students during the testing window. And so schools are really looking at this situation as needing certainty in what's going to happen. Because if they're going to have to suddenly give the MEAP next year that they weren't planning to because they've been preparing for this other test, the MEAP exam, as it's been for the last 3 years, is not going to directly be assessing the material that they've been teaching this year as they prepare for giving these Smarter Balanced exams.
Brian, is this more, do you think, a case of a stubborn legislature that will not let school administrators and principals and teachers be educators and run their schools and do what they feel is best? Or is it a state superintendent who is equally stubborn and refusing to be flexible?
Well, I think, at least in large part, there are some legislators, and Representative McMillan being one of them in particular, who have expressed to me concerns that the Department of Ed and the State Board of Education are making these decisions without consulting with the legislature about what it's going to cost. They're not saying, this is how much money we're going to need to do this. And so there are some legislators who really feel like it should be their job to ratify the decisions that the State Board of Ed is making based on the fact that they hold the purse strings. Because while the State Board of Education and the state superintendent have the authority to make decisions about the public schools in this state, ultimately paying for it falls to the legislature to spend the money as they see fit. And so there's a bit of a turf battle over who's making these decisions and who's paying for them.
Well, let me ask you, do you think deep down, is it budget concerns, or is it just lawmakers like Representative McMillan, who deeply oppose Common Core, is insisting on the old MEAP a way to torpedo Common Core?
There are some, and I think Representative McMillan would probably agree that that's one way that people are looking at trying to slow down this implementation of Common Core, because people have concerns about issues of local control.
Right.
Some people see the Common Core as sort of a overreach into telling local schools how to teach material and what they need to be teaching. There are a lot of people who believe that it is some sort of federal mandate. It's not. This was a collaborative effort between governors from multiple states, the National Governors Association being involved in it. And again, the testing has been led by individual states. There was some federal Race to the Top money that helped get the ball rolling on putting these tests together, but decisions about the questions that are going to be asked and how these tests are going to be given have been made by states working together.
So with just 6 weeks or so left in this school year, Brian, what should we watch for? What's next?
Well, I think it's ultimately going to depend on whether or not this budget provision stays in the budget as it's drafted right now. Clearly, we're still fairly early in the budget process, mm-hmm. although there has been a push in recent years to sort of get a budget done fairly early and not go up to the wire. If this does stick around, then the Michigan Department of Education is going to be bound to figure out how to give the meet next year and how to reconcile that with telling the federal government that they're going to be giving these other exams. And it's ultimately going to be a question of which side wins the day, whether the state sticks with what it's contracted to do through Smarter Balanced right now, which that contract runs for the next 3 years. They're already field testing those exams in a lot of schools right now, sort of preparing to make sure that everything's working. But if that doesn't happen, then the Michigan Department of Education is going to have to dust off the MEEP and put it back out there next year.
Brian Smith, MLive Education and Courts reporter. Thanks for trying to figure this all out for us, Brian.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's called Music in Our Parks. After 2 years of planning, the new music ensemble at Grand Valley State University is launching a new project called Music in Our Parks. And you're listening to one of the pieces from that project, which shows how nature and landscape affect the process of making music. Joining us now from Grand Valley State University is Bill Ryan, director of the GVSU New Music Ensemble. Good to have you back on Stateside, Bill.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
And we welcome one of the members of the new music ensemble. He's a percussionist and a senior music performance major, Joshua Dreyer. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Bill, spell out for us just what is the Music in Our Parks project.
Well, what we're doing is we commissioned five composers to write works in response to parks out in the Southwest United States. And we got the pieces this year and rehearsed them, and now we're traveling to those parks. So we're going to perform the music in the settings that inspired them.
How did that connection between the GVSU New Music Ensemble and Southwest Parks come to be?
Well, that's probably my doing, because I love to backpack and camp and spend time in the outdoors, and have actually toured that area with my family a couple of years ago. So I was trying to think of a way that I could combine my passions, music and the outdoors, and this is what I came up with.
And where did the composers come from?
We have a current student that wrote a piece, a former student that wrote a piece, another one from Michigan. There's a Washington, D.C. one. So there's a wide representation, I guess, of composers, but they all have share this passion with us in terms of the national parks.
Well, let's take a listen right now to a piece. It's called Night Sketches by Ashley Stanley. Now, Ashley is a student member of the ensemble, and seriously, this is her first composition?
Yeah, Ashley's a senior at Grand Valley, and she's a performance major, flutist, and wanted to take compositions this year as a way to give her a little insight into her playing. And so she started in the fall, wrote this early in the fall semester, and we were all sort of blown away on the results.
I think she's opened the door to some new ways to express her gifts. Joshua Dreyer, can you give us a sense of what playing outdoors? You're going to be playing someplace like Arches National Park in Utah. How does playing outdoors inspire and inform your performance?
It's a different environment, and it's getting used to responding to the environments you play in is an extremely difficult process. And from night to night, we play in different halls, and it's always a process of adjusting to what it sounds like and what it feels like. And outdoors is something that you don't get used to because you don't have a lot of opportunities to play outdoors. Some of the pieces we have, one of the pieces, we actually go out in the parks and we have field recorders and we can record sounds of nature. And those will be played back during the piece. That piece is a Red Vesper. And it's a, sort of a different aspect of it, interacting with an environment that is not very common.
So it's really a sense, it gives us as the audience a sense of how nature and landscape can really influence the music-making process.
Yeah, precisely.
Now, I have to ask, are there any plans to do something similar to this in Michigan parks? I think what we can all say, we feel a little jealous that the folks out in the Southwest get a crack at listening to this.
Yeah, this is a long-term hope that I haven't shared with anyone, is that this is very successful. And, I mean, there are a lot of parks across this country, a lot of beautiful places to see. And I would love to have this only be the first installment of this idea, where we do this annually or every other year. And by the end, we'll have taken this project to every national park in the country, including Michigan's. Yeah.
So we will look forward to that. We've been speaking with Bill Ryan, Grand Valley State University. He directs the New Music Ensemble. And with Josh Dreyer, a percussionist and a member of the New Music Ensemble. Their parks tour is now until May 6th. Who needs caffeine? I know I could use some right about now. You know, it is pretty tough to imagine an American city that does not have a coffee shop. In a lot of places, Starbucks blazed the trail, followed by other chains, and then the hip, locally owned coffee shops. The variety of flavors and roasts we drink has certainly evolved, from those big brands, the Folgers, the Maxwell Houses, to regionally labeled coffees, and now to beans sourced from farms, not just from countries. So what is in the future for the actual brick-and-mortar coffee shop? We're joined now by Anya Pomacala. She's the chief barista at Zingerman's Coffee Company in Ann Arbor. So good to have you with us, Anya.
Thank you for having me.
And we welcome from Grand Rapids, we have Ryan Knapp, who's the co-founder and director of coffee for Madcap Coffee. Hello, Ryan.
Hi, how's it going?
Very good. I'm going to start with you, Ryan. How long have you been in coffee? What brought you to coffee?
Yeah, really, it all started with the same introduction a lot of people have where, you know, you just need a cup of coffee. Everyone's doing it, so you say, why not? I really fell in love with that coffee shop experience about 8 years back.
What about you, Anya? What brought you to coffee for your avocation?
Well, like most college students, I was in a desperate need of caffeine. ended up at a small coffee roastery in the Upper Peninsula where I went to school, and just hung out there enough that they decided to hire me, and it was all downhill from there.
What do you think, and I'll start with you, Anya, what changes do you think you have seen in coffee shops in the time you've been in the business and in what you're selling?
Well, I think coffee shops really originated out of people's desire for a third space. They need a place to go where they're not at home and having to do home things, and they're not at work doing work things. They're at another place where they can think independent outside of that and meet with people that they wouldn't otherwise experience. I think that's really what helped build coffee shops, and definitely, historically speaking, it has. In the United States specifically, I think the drive for really high-quality coffee comes out of a movement for people looking for something more than what they've had, more than what their parents had.
And what's your perspective, Ryan? What have you seen?
Yeah, I would agree. You know, a lot of what brings people to a coffee shop is that community, a place to sit and be with other people. And it's an exciting time because as I was getting into it, they'd already started on to what they've kind of viewed as kind of this third wave type of thing where it was becoming a lot more about the coffee. It was becoming highlighting origins. It was becoming how can we make the very, very, very best cup of coffee. And I think something that we kind of suffered through the specialty coffee movement back then is coffee people, you know, myself included, I was in that boat. We got so excited about coffee that we sometimes forgot about the bigger picture, and that's delivering a fantastic experience. So I feel like we're really trying to get back to that spot where, you know, we want to deliver the very, 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 very best coffee, and a lot goes into that. But at the end of the day, we also want to provide this fantastic experience. So when somebody walks through that door, they're not only getting a superb cup of coffee, but it's getting served in great glassware. The baristas are being very friendly, and maybe they'll learn something when they walk away.
How did it suffer, do you think, Ryan, when you were all caught up in the product?
I think for a lot of us, you know, I can admit, you know, I've been there, but for a lot of our industry, we got so like starstruck with this idea where we're like, oh my gosh, coffee is as complex as wine. Some could argue it's even more complex with all the work that goes into it. And just realizing that when you really break it down and look at it, you know, there's hundreds of different varieties. There's little pockets of microclimates all over the world that each microclimate, each soil, each variety, and all of this process produces a new, outstanding, unique flavor. And I think as a whole, the coffee industry kind of went through a phase where it's like, we really want to like cram this exciting information down everyone's throats. And I think we're kind of backing off and saying, you know, you can have a good experience and a good cup of coffee without knowing everything about it. And then trying to balance out how we give information and maybe even the personality that we give it to. So I think the same can be true with some great restaurants or great wine bars. Sometimes with a great product, pretension comes along with it. So I think as an industry, we're really saying we don't want that to come along with coffee because it shouldn't be involved with coffee at all.
A coffee shop should never be pretentious.
That's my opinion, yeah.
If you just joined us, we're talking coffee and coffee shops as we speak with Ryan Knapp, who's the co-founder and director of coffee for Madcap Coffee in Grand Rapids, joined by Anya Pamakala, who's the chief barista at Zingerman's Coffee Company in Ann Arbor. And Anya, it does seem that coffee has been especially instrumental in getting us to think about food justice and bringing to the forefront fair trade and labor as we think about food. Am I right about that, that coffee seemed to start that, and do you see that continuing?
You know, I couldn't speak to whether or not it started. It absolutely is more prominent in people's minds. It's easy, much easier now than it has ever been to go into a store and find coffee that has a fair trade label and has, you know, a Rainforest Alliance label or is shade grown and good for the birds. And it's wonderful and definitely a really important part of the industry. But it's just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to looking for quality and looking for fair prices for growers. It's good to have that consciousness. I'm excited to see the next step of where we're going to go with that consciousness for our customer base.
Where do you think it might go?
I'm really hoping that it goes more along the lines of knowing exactly who grows it, getting more growers' names on the bag. What's the person who actually grew it? How much are they as an individual getting paid instead of having more of a middle person who's saying that we're doing this, having the consumer actually know that, like, Carlos, you know, grew this in Huelo and having a broader scope. It's much like having your local gardener and knowing that this farm grew my cabbage and they grew my carrots and who actually grew your coffee.
I want to shift our conversation a bit to the experience of coming into a coffee shop. And as you both know well, one of the big issues all around the country for coffee shops are folks coming in, plugging their laptops into that free Wi-Fi and parking themselves for hours. I have seen the term laptop hobos as I was doing a search on this. And I kind of wondered, how do you balance the desire of folks to roost in your coffee shop for a good long period with the desire of people who want a table to sit in when they do come in? Is that something you struggle with at Madcap Coffee, Ryan?
I don't think so, really. You know, like, we've got some fantastic customers and we get to see their faces on a daily basis. And sometimes they'll plug in a laptop and spend some time there. If you want to just have that, you know, Italian experience to step up to the bar, sip an espresso and leave, we've got a space for that. My only hope would be if you sit for a while, make sure you tip your barista. You know, they'll love it. You know, they earned it too.
That's true. How do you handle this question at Zingerman's?
We don't really differentiate between our customers because a customer is a customer regardless. And if they come in and bring their laptop and want to sit for a long period of time, I try to view it as a compliment. They come to us because they enjoy our space, they enjoy our company, and ideally they also enjoy our product. We do have a separate section in case of an overflow of customers where people who want to spend more of a communal time can work. But we try not to differentiate their customers regardless. And if they want to sit there for 8 hours, that's fine. It's good to have their company. And I would completely tag on with Ryan and say, if you're going to hang out, baristas really appreciate the tips.
I always add money to the cup after.
It does
also seem to me that there's some degree of back and forthing for coffee shops about how far you go in offering food beyond the scones and the muffins and the other pastries. Do you think you need to have food to survive as a coffee shop? And I know, Anya, your perspective is part of the world-famous Zingerman's. You bring a little something different to the conversation. I want to start with Ryan on that, just because you don't have the power of a great Zingerman sandwich behind
yeah,
you.
Yeah, we don't have that. No, but fortunately, you know, we've teamed up. Our focus at Madcap has been, you know, let's do coffee and let's do it as well as we can. And that's been a big enough challenge to try to perfect buying, roasting, brewing, and serving coffee really well. So for us, we just said, let's be as simple as possible with our focus so that we can do it really well, and let's seek out great partners if we're going to do anything else.
I'm wondering what, and we kind of touched on this a little bit, your hopes for the coffee shops and coffee looking ahead for the next 10 years, Anya, but give us a sense of what, I'll start with you, what your hopes are and what you see in the next decade for coffee shops, what you'll be selling, and what the experience will be for the customer.
Well, I think that the coffee industry is at this really unique, wonderful stage. We've gone through the introduction of coffee to the global economy. We've gone through improving the quality through time. And now, as Ryan mentioned, we're really working on improving the service side of it, giving the customers a really good experience without being overbearing, having a space to have more education on the product that people consume on a nearly daily basis. It's hard to fathom where exactly it's going to go because I feel like we're at a stage where anything could happen. I would love to see more small roasters all over the country where people rely on someone that they know personally. Having that interaction with your roaster, with your barista, is really just the next step to building a community of people who care about the product, and not just the people who make it every day, but the people who drink it every day. I mean, I drink lots of coffee, but it doesn't help if, you know,
yes,
if you think that Folgers is the best thing, or, you
sure
know, coffee that you're getting at the gas station is the pinnacle of your coffee experience. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what the creative group of people that are working in this economy is really going to create.
And from where you sit, Ryan, what are your hopes?
I'm really excited, and we've already seen this to a great degree, but I'm, of course, looking to push forward with it, is just really high-end, delicious cups of coffee. I'm on the road about a quarter of the year, you know, visiting producers, visiting small farms, and just discovering new, beautiful, small plots of lands all over the world. And there's producers out there that are putting so much time and energy into producing coffee that is, you know, just mind-blowing, just really amazing. So I'm really excited just to see that grow and awareness being brought back to the people who put a lot of work into making coffee possible. It's a very labor-intensive beverage.
And it's one that I dare say most of us would not be able to live without. That was Ryan Knapp. He's co-founder and director of coffee with Madcap Coffee in Grand Rapids. And he was joined by Anya Pamakala, who's the chief barista at Zingerman's Coffee Company in Ann Arbor. And now you've both got me wanting a great, big, gorgeous cup of coffee. So thank you so much for joining us on Stateside.
Thank you
so
much.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 75 years ago brought the publication of one of the most influential books of the 20th century. It sold over 30 million copies, and it's changed the lives of millions of people around the world. I'm talking about what's known as the Big Book. The official title is Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. It was written by the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill Wilson, Bill W. I'm joined now by Dr. Howard Markell, who's director of the Center for History of Medicine at the University of Michigan. Dr. Markell, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
As you consider historic moments in medicine, where does this big book stand in your view?
It's huge. It's huge. You know, every author has the fantasy, generally when they're writing their book early in the morning or late at night, that people are going to actually buy and read and get something from their book. And this book has had, as you said, 30 million copies. That's a lot of copies. And it is still as relevant today as it was 75 years ago. It was published April 10th, 1939. And not only has it been influential because people have read it, but they have taken the principles and tenets to heart. The most successful have recovered from the debilitating disease alcoholism. And versions of that book have been recast for the big books of Narcotics Anonymous or Gamblers Anonymous or what have you. So all the 12-step programs that we know about, Overeating Anonymous and on, have all used the AA big book as its source.
And thinking of this man, Bill Wilson, and the name that is forever linked with Alcoholics Anonymous. But I can you tell us about him? Like, what was his background, and how long did he struggle to get sober?
Well, Bill Wilson, or Bill W., as he was known, mm-hmm. because it's Alcoholics Anonymous,
right.
was the co-founder of it. He was a remarkable man and had quite the ego as well. He was a World War I vet. He came back to the United States and lived in New York. He married a lovely woman named Lois Wilson, and he was interested in the stock market. And he – this is before the crash.
Okay.
He had the novel idea of checking out companies that you should invest in by actually going to the companies, going to their factories, being an undercover agent, if you will, and seeing how these companies work. And then he would write his colleagues in New York, you know, this company is a good one, this one is not, mm-hmm. this is well managed, and so on. But he began drinking very early on as a young man, probably before he was even a soldier in World War I, but that's where he really started it.
And I imagine many young soldiers did come home with that.
Yeah, and you know, problem. There is this, we didn't know about it then, but there is this predisposition to alcoholism, probably genetic, that, and you can kind of tell those people that are their first time out, they go really out there.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time in the 1930s, when he had lost his business and was really living on his wife's salary as a department store clerk, and they were living in his father-in-law's house in Brooklyn, he was quite the two-quart-a-day rot-gut alcoholic. He was quite destitute. They lived in a brownstone in Brooklyn, and he put a mattress out on the sidewalk by his window in case he jumped. So he was so despondent, so depressed. And he had gone to the equivalent of rehab hospitals mm-hmm. a number of times. There was a hospital on Central Park West. It was called the Towns Hospital, owned by a man named Charles Towns. And it had a cure, so-called cure for alcoholism. It was something called the Belladonna cure. And you took copious amounts of Belladonna.
Which is a poison.
It is a poison.
Okay.
It will also make you hallucinate. And by the way, withdrawing from alcohol will potentially make you hallucinate.
The DTs,
and being an alcoholic might make you hallucinate. So he had gone there several times, but the final time he went, the fourth time he went, he had had a lovely meeting with an old drinking buddy, a guy named Ebbie Thatcher, who is forever recorded in the annals of Alcoholics Anonymous history. And Ebbie had found religion. He had joined a Christian group called the Oxford Group. And through that – and the Oxford Group was a big movement of Christianity in the early 20s and 30s. They had four absolutes, absolute purity or chastity, mm-hmm. Honesty, unselfishness, and love. So those are the four absolutes. And he took Bill to the Bowery Street Mission where there were a lot of drunks, you know, the famous Skid Row of New York City, and talked to him quite a bit about it. But Bill wasn't really interested. Shortly after he went to the Towns Hospital, was being heavily dosed on Belladonna, Peraldehyde, a number of other sedatives. And he had this moment, this famous spiritual awakening that he writes about where he saw a light. He said, you know, God, if there is a way out of this, help me. And that was the spiritual awakening that he writes about that he urges on all alcoholics to have. It's complicated. And,
yes.
And it whether
it's the hitting bottom and then –
it's hitting bottom and then actually in some way seeing a higher power that something can get you out of this beyond yourself. And it's been interpreted many different ways and some people's spiritual experiences are different than others. Some might be in increments that you just see that things are getting better. His was quite dramatic, and whether it was a hallucination or real – does it really matter?
Because it did the job.
Because it did the job. And so he became very interested in, you know, he was a very enthusiastic man, and he wanted to help other alcoholics. And he tried using the Oxford Group tenets, but the Oxford Group tenets really were very mired in their religious faith, and that didn't work out so well. So he started his own group a few months later, about 6 months later, when he was on a business trip to Akron, Ohio. And there he was in Akron, and he was newly recovered, about 6 months sober. And he was in a hotel lobby, and he could have gone to the right where there was a lovely bar and people are drinking highballs and champagne and beer and having a great time. Or he could have – there was a bank of phones and a directory like there used to be in hotels of all the various churches and the ministers and the priests and so on who ran each church. And so he just started going through and called each minister or priest, "Do you have a drunk I could talk to? I'm a recovering alcoholic. I think I need to talk to another drunk." And that's where the idea of only another alcoholic can help an alcoholic or an addict can help an addict, because they understand the bottom, as you refer like no other person. And it also was it's a brilliant move, because by talking to that other alcoholic, you're actually helping yourself.
There you go.
You know, it's a really a dual therapy there. And one minister said, "Well, you know, there's a doctor. He's a well-known surgeon, Dr. Bob Smith. By the way, he got kicked out of the University of Michigan Medical School."
Did he? Bob Smith.
Yeah. We don't see his picture on the walls at the University of Michigan Medical School. But he was a surgeon who was quite a drunk. And he had been also a member of the Oxford Group, and nothing worked. And the two met. They hit it off. Dr. Bob said, "This guy really knows what I'm going through."
Huh.
You know, that identification of another person.
An aha moment.
Right. Yeah. Right, right. And so the two of them became very enthusiastic and started working one at a time, first in Akron and then elsewhere, New York, with other alcoholics trying to help them. And think about it. Two guys come to a hospital room on the drunk ward and said, "We're going to help you." They must have been, you know, thought to be crazy.
Yeah.
And but they worked it out as they went along. And over the next 3 years, they came up actually with 6 steps, not 12 steps.
The 12 steps that we know today really began as 6.
Right. Okay. And they were – they're really an abbreviation of the 12 steps. So you admit that you're powerless over alcohol, which is still the first step.
Mm-hmm.
We got honest with ourselves. We got honest with another person in confidence, which is still the fourth and fifth step.
Mm-hmm.
We made amends for harms that we did to others, which is the eighth and ninth step. And we worked with other alcoholics without demand for prestige or money. That last part is critically important. It was never about money. It was never about professionalism. They were tempted at many points, as was Bill W. tempted.
Yeah.
And I think that lack of being part of the American medical establishment or the recovery establishment, which we now see, really, really was critically important. It was not about money. It was about helping other people. And then there was we prayed to God to help us to do the things as best we could. Now, while they wrote those 6 steps, Bill decided in a – you know, and he was – as I said, he was a very impetuous, enthusiastic, must have been a pain in the neck kind of guy. And he decided, well, you know, these steps are too general, and he within 30 minutes wrote the 12 steps that we you can look up.
Yes.
But in the original iteration of the steps, because he was a deeply religious Christian, there was a lot of talk about God. So there was, you know, it's only by appealing to a God that we could get this lifted off of us. And in one step, the original fifth step, he said, "We urge you to kneel before God and pray for
And where does that leave the person who isn't so sure about God?
Exactly. And so there were other groups of AA in Akron, New York, and so on. And the writing of the big book, even though Bill Wilson is on the copyright form, if you look up the Library of Congress copyright, it says, you know, William G. Wilson. It was written by many people of the original members. Most of them had about a year and a half sobriety. So these were not, you know.
Yeah, they weren't long-timers.
No. Yeah. But that was it. So they wrote it, and there was one member who said, you know, "I really don't like this God stuff." He was an agnostic. And there is a famous chapter in the big book called A Chapter to the Agnostic. And the idea that he introduced was that, well, all you have to do is believe in something bigger than yourself. That's where the higher power comes from.
Whatever it is
that
works for you.
It can be the spirituality of the group. Some people think it's something else, you know. And there are people who do believe in God. There are those others who don't. But that substitute of religion, organized religion as we understand it, for spirituality, of a sense of something greater than yourself, really saved the day. And in fact, there were earlier groups for alcoholics, like the Washingtonians in the 19th century, that, and the Oxford group, that were so connected in that case to the Christian faith. Because what if you believe in God but you're not Christian?
Sure.
Or Jewish or Muslim or what have you. So that separation, this believing in something else, was a stroke of brilliance. And the fact that Bill W. could back off on his own very enthusiastic ideas was his own, I think, brilliance beyond coming up with all this. And so it was very much a group effort, and then the 12 steps were developed and became part of the big book in 1939.
So it was without agenda. It was without personal gain. Here you are. I want to help you.
Yeah.
So the purity of it, when you think about the reason behind the writing of the book and forming the Alcoholics Anonymous, and here it is, speaking to people 75 years later, just as strongly as it did in 1939.
Yeah, and when you can imagine when there was only a handful of groups.
Yes.
The only way to spread the gospel, if you will, was to write a book. And even though now there's hundreds of thousands of groups all over 170 or more countries, and there's millions of members, that book is still the ambassador to not only every newcomer but every old timer. And there are parts of the book that are quaintly dated. For example, they refer to alcoholism as an allergy because that was a metaphor that made sense in 1939. But if you get – and some of the writing is somewhat stilted, frankly.
So it has not been updated, edited?
Well,
the
first 164 pages are the original 164 pages. Then there are the stories of strength, hope, and experience by members telling their own story that is updated at various intervals.
Okay.
So, for example, the original stories were all probably white men.
Mm-hmm.
And so in order to have diversity of minority candidates and so on involved, women alcoholics.
Mm-hmm.
That was a long trudge in and of itself to have women members of Alcoholics Anonymous. So that has evolved. But the original 164 pages is pretty much the same as it was in 1939. And if you look at – they have actually published the manuscript. You see all the little handwriting. We believe that this should be changed to this or to that. So it was very much a group effort. And when I – having been at the University of Michigan for many years, you can't get a memo that's been written by 10 people, let alone a book. So the fact that they all stuck together and these were people of very strong opinions – and produce that book makes it all the more miraculous.
You think about it, Dr. Markle. As a physician, do you find yourself thinking of the sheer number of lives this book has saved in the decades?
Yeah, that would be a wonderful study to do, wouldn't it? Alcoholism has a very high what's called recidivism rate. Mm-hmm. So within 5 years, many people relapse. And it's a relapsing disease. It's funny. If somebody has diabetes and they need a new insulin dose, we don't call that a relapse or a failure, but we do with alcoholism and addiction. But it has saved countless lives. It would be interesting to a study if you could design one. And also, it was a non-medical approach, and it remains non-medical. Now, a lot of addictionologists and people who study alcoholism and addiction have embraced that, but that took a while. And in the late 30s, early 40s, when the medical industrial complex was very different than it is today,
yes.
This was very much looked upon as, sort of a layperson's thing, and it wasn't given the credibility that it has today.
And here today, we do have a real sense of the spiritual as being a part of the healing process that did not exist then.
No, 1939 is really the height, the zenith of the scientific, the golden scientific era of medicine. Whether they had the science or not, it was that science was going to carry the day.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great novel, Aerosmith, by Sinclair Lewis,
which
is a Michigan story in and of itself.
Yeah.
But his prayer is, God, give me faith not to believe in God. So this whole notion of separation from the scientific, the quantitative, what you could see, smell, and hear from the spiritual. We've actually changed quite a bit since the 1960s and 70s and 80s. And this mind-body connection and a connection to something bigger than yourself is something that's taught down the street where I work and was not taught so heavily when I was a student there in the early 1980s. So we have learned, the medical profession have learned, that there is more to healing than just what we write with our prescription pad or what we dissect with our scalpel.
A fascinating conversation. Dr. Howard Markle, who is the George E. Wants Distinguished Professor of the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan and Director of the Center for the History of Medicine, looking at the very, very significant 75th anniversary of the big book that has been giving alcoholics hope for all these decades. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And here at Stateside, we always want to hear from you. What stories are you talking about and issues that are on your mind? Let us know. You can find us on Facebook or on Twitter. We're at Stateside Radio. And, of course, you can find us on the website, michiganradio.org. Just click on that link that says Stateside, and while you're there, you can check out stories or interviews that you might have missed.
I hear that old piano from down the avenue.
And of course, you know that music, the opening to A Prairie Home Companion. Well, be sure to tune in tomorrow on Stateside. I'll be talking with Garrison Keillor about A Prairie Home Companion's 40th anniversary and about Garrison's new book, The Keillor Reader. And on our Facebook, we asked you just what questions do you have for the host of A Prairie Home Companion? I've got just a moment or two to read some of these questions. Dan says he wants to know why English majors are so defensive around linguistics majors. Chris just wants to know how it is that Garrison's always been able to remain so awesome. And Jeremy wants to know why the Insane Clown Posse has not yet appeared on A Prairie Home Companion. He says he's assuming it's because of scheduling conflicts. One might argue demographic differences might have something to do with that. Not so sure about that, Jeremy. Be sure to tune in tomorrow on Stateside. We will have Garrison Keillor answer some of your questions. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattelsey, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Omar Sude, Clara Tanisketter, and Jeff Warniak. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.